Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, where Easter baskets can be filled with chef-prepared holiday meals, Easter lilies, Easter candy, and more.
The documentary Join or Die begins with a tour of the Oddfellows Hall in Waxahachie, Texas. This is Lodge number 80.
We've been meeting in this room since 1913. The presiding officer sits at the front of the room. Secretary's desk is there, the treasurer, each one of these stations.
50, 60 years ago in this country, there were places like it everywhere. The Elks, the Freemasons, the Lions, the Kiwanis.
Oddfellows have always kind of referred to themselves as a friendly society rather than a secret society. But there are mysteries to the order that we won't divulge.
The film says, really, there is no America without clubs and fraternal orders and church groups and bowling leagues. The social scientist Robert Putnam singled out the bowling leagues for the title of his influential book, Bowling Alone, in 2000. Putnam pulled together data on everything from religious attendance and civic memberships to see just how people engaged in their communities and socialized in everyday life. And he found the slow rituals of belonging in this country are in deep decline. The brother and sister filmmaking team, Rebecca and Pete Davis, wanted to make a film about Putnam's work and whether it still applies today. So back in 2017, they reached out to him. Here's Rebecca.
It was the year Robert Putnam was retiring from teaching. And at the same time, I was at that point still working full time in the mainstream media. I was a video producer for NBC News. And I was flying around the country covering a lot of the symptoms of this bowling alone phenomenon. So, you know, I was covering things like school shootings, the opioid epidemic, veterans struggling with suicide. And one of those stories did bring me out to Utah, actually. I was in Provo covering this great nonprofit called Encircle that creates community resources for LGBTQ students, you know, many of whom had been struggling with suicide and seeking connection. And this was, you know, a shining star in kind of the bowling alone phenomenon, because this group had seen a problem in the community, a crisis in rising teen suicide numbers, and said, you know, what is the community solution to this problem? And they bought a house in downtown Provo and created, you know, a beautiful community center. I think they have a couple locations now around the state of Utah that's providing healing through community. I was craving for more stories like this one that wasn't just pointing to, you know, a crisis, and I think filling, you know, our viewing audience with anxiety and hopelessness, but was giving a positive example of community leaders who saw a problem in their community and heard the call to do something about it. And I think, you know, that was something Pete and I then later hoped to do with our film, which was, how do we find some community leaders that are taking up this call, like this founder, her name was Stephanie Larson, in Provo, was doing with Encircle? Because ultimately, you know, I think I was starting to feel that it was going to be a lot easier to get Americans to act on our crises from a place of inspiration than from a place of hopelessness.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about Rebecca and Pete Davis's documentary about Robert Putnam and the decline in American social capital. It's called Join or Die. We're going to be screening the film tonight at the Downtown Salt Lake City Library. We'll have more details here in a minute. Right up front, the documentary states its intention. It says it's a film about why you should join a club and why the fate of America depends on it. Here's Pete.
You know, most documentaries about a social problem spend 95% of the movie talking about the problem, and you hear all these horror stories and everything bad is happening. And then in the final 5 minutes, right before the credits roll, or maybe sometimes even they wait until the credits roll,
yeah,
they say, you know, if you want to help, you can sign this petition at our film's website, or you can write your congressman, or make sure to raise awareness about this. And they put the solution at the end of the movie. And social isolation, it's one of the worst social problems. It's the cause of so many societal and personal and public health ills. But we didn't want a movie that was in that format of dark, 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 and then a little bit of the light at the end. We wanted to flip the script and say, well, what is the other side of a social isolation crisis? The other side of a social isolation crisis is a vibrant civic and community life. And so we wanted to say this is more of a movie about the future we could have and the past we have had of a more vibrant American community life. And then we wanted to bring it totally down to earth and say, well, okay, what is the literal call to action? And the call to action is you, the viewer, right now watching this, we want you to join a club. And club we're using as the shtick to mean any type of associational life, a congregation, a union, a political party, getting together in your neighborhood in a routine way, any community initiative that brings people together. You know, we say this is a film about why you should join a club and why the fate of America depends on it. We hope if you're completely confused about why something so goofy as joining a club is spoken in such grave terms as the fate of America will depend on it.
Yeah.
We hope that if you're feeling tense and confused about that at the beginning of the movie, by the end of the movie, you totally get what we meant by that.
It's interesting because the film is, in part, it's a profile of Robert Putnam, or it's anyway, you go along with Putnam on his, the arc of his life, as he later describes it, his journey to understand all of this. But it's also important, as you just said, I think, to say you want this film to be useful. Like you want to be more than just observers of a phenomenon. You want it to help. Is that fair to say?
Totally. You know, we see the film as an organizing tool.
Yeah. You know, and I think we set out, you know, we did not want to just do a biopic of Robert Putnam. But, you know, there was this kind of nice thing that happened with this story in particular where Bob's work and Bob's life follow the same trajectory. So he charts the decline in American civic life, which follows the same trajectory of, you know, Robert Putnam being born at this, you know, moment of higher social capital. And then over the course of his career, while he's studying this phenomenon, you know, this data is declining over that time. And, you know, it can be hard to set out to do a documentary on a big theme without a human character. Yeah. And so, you know, in this way, you know, Bob, both through his life and through his work, is kind of representing this phenomenon that's taking place in America over the last half century.
Pete, you say in the film, there is no America without clubs.
In the background of the American story, behind the presidents and wars, recessions and boom tides, scientific breakthroughs and social movements, are clubs. Clubs like Charleston's Phyllis Wheatley Club, founded in 1916 to discuss books and serve the community. Or Ben Franklin's Junto Club, which met every Friday evening in Philadelphia for philosophical debates. Or the California Coast Girls Surf Club, launched in 1961 to gather young women to ride the South Bay waves.
You know, the foundation of our country, you could say, if we wanted to be academic about it, the sociological foundation for our country are times when we've gotten together in associations in various forms to get anything done. And the way to see that is if you go to the history of any major development in the history of our country and you look beneath the surface of the presidents and the wars and the big decisions in Washington and New York and Harvard, but look out in the, you know, what was behind all this, what was happening 20 years before the Civil Rights Movement, 20 years before the Constitution was signed, 20 years before, you know, the abolitionist movement succeeded with the 13th Amendment. What you'll see is people getting together in associations. Let me just give you a few examples. The reason we have playgrounds in America, you know, you think we've always had playgrounds and public parks in America. Well, there was an American playground movement that was a bunch of people getting together in organizations. You know, the Montgomery bus boycott if you look at accounts of it, it's an account of a bunch of clubs coming together, the Bricklayers Union, a bunch of different congregations. Rosa Parks, she was chosen to be the person that was going to be the inciting event of sitting on the bus because she was well connected to everyone because she was secretary of the local branch of the NAACP. Our own constitution, you know, starts with a culture of people congregating so that by the time we needed a Continental Congress, people were already used to coming together in like various ways to do things in the colonies. You know, all of these stories have clubs behind them, from the goofiest thing of, you know, anytime a sport takes off, it's usually because of clubs or a hobby, yeah, you know, model cars or model airplanes, all the way to the biggest social revolutions in our country. There's clubs behind it.
What happens, and we'll dig into this in a minute, but just give us a kind of a sketch. What happens when a country built on associations, as you say, turns to be a country of a lot of people saying, I'm not really a joiner?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, that was what really drew us to Robert Putnam's work. He's famous for popularizing this idea of social capital, and that's these levels of trust and reciprocity that are built out of our associational life. And, you know, at the time that we approached him in 2017 about the possibility of this film, you know, a lot of people in our generation were thinking that what it meant to be part of a democracy was getting to the polls and voting. And, mm-hmm. you know, we will never say that that is not important. But what we're hoping to do in this film is bring back more attention to the participatory side of things, the other four-letter word besides vote, which is join.
Let's talk about your relationship as filmmakers, and yours in particular, Pete, but yours, Rebecca, too, with Robert Putnam. Is it right to say, Pete, you narrate the film, and so is it right to say it's kind of personal?
Yeah, you know, I was a student of Robert Putnam 13 years ago now. And, you know, I was a political science major who, you know, came to school thinking that politics was about what happens in Washington. And while most classes were in that direction, Robert Putnam's over here teaching a Community in America class saying the most important presidents in this country are the presidents of your local Rotary Club. The most important thing happening in our democracy is what's happening in ordinary neighborhoods and social movements and civic associations. And that was just a totally mind-blowing different way of looking at politics. It's a total lens shift.
Mm. There's a great scene in the film where you're driving around with Bob Putnam and he's just pointing out, oh yeah, there's the Kiwanis Club, there's the Lions Club, a Rotary Club.
Here's Unit 11 of the American Legion. And what you could also see is that's the Little League Park, Christian Science Reading Room. This is the First Congregational Church. Sorry, hold on just 1 second. There's the Rod and Gun Recreation Area, which is another common kind of club up here.
I think a lot of people, certainly those of us of a certain age, are going to remember that time in American history when there was an Odd Fellows Club and, just go down the list. I think it's going to spark a kind of memory for a lot of people, because it certainly did with me.
Totally. And I think when we start looking around, you can see those artifacts everywhere, you know, in most of our main streets. And I think the fact that that was so often, you know, the sign that people saw the first thing when they drove into the city limits shows just how important, you know, the fabric of our civic life was at a time, you know, for our cities. And I think, you know, this is one of the great ironies now of having so much information at our fingertips. One of the biggest things that Pete and I have heard as we've been touring this film from community members is, I want to get involved. I don't know where to look. We used to have it posted, you know, right on the city limits when you drove into town. And now, you know, in my phone, I can pull up, you know, club meetings that are happening halfway across the world. Yeah. But, you know, I can get overwhelmed with all that information and, you know, find it harder to find out what's happening down the street.
Let's talk about Robert Putnam's early life that sort of leads him where he ends up. Grows up in a really tiny town in Ohio. And his dad was in World War II. His dad was in a club. He's in Kiwanis, I think it was. And Robert himself belonged to everything.
I went back to look at my own high school yearbook. I belonged to everything.
And that's a picture of my bowling team. I'm the tall one in the middle.
One of our favorite archival work is my sister flew out to the Owosso County Historic Society of Port Clinton, Ohio, where Bob grew up. And what's amazing is, you know, we wanted to get a sense of Bob, but we also used this as an excuse to get a sense of civic life at the time when Bob was growing up, that he writes about as kind of one of the peaks of civic life in America in the mid-century. And what you see, if, and I recommend this to anyone, go to your local historic society, you'll see how it was so normal to be a joiner. So we found a thing called a civic directory, which was a document that they gave out to everyone that would list all the clubs in town. So part of our goal was to show Bob was part of the norm. It wasn't that he was especially a joiner.
Pete Davis, he and his sister Rebecca Davis are co-directors of the documentary Join or Die, which we're going to be screening tonight at 7 at the Downtown Salt Lake City Library. This is our partnership with Utah Film Center. You can get more details at radiowest.org. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, where Easter baskets can be filled with chef-prepared holiday meals, Easter lilies, Easter candy, and more.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The documentary film Join or Die is about the life's work of the social scientist Robert Putnam, whose book Bowling Alone documented the erosion of civic life in the U.S. Putnam drew on data from church attendance records, from club and union memberships, from political participation rates, even things like time use diaries and lifestyle surveys. And this was kind of part of his gift, uncovering these obscure records that painted a larger picture, like picnics. This was one of these micro indicators Putnam dug into, surveys that tracked how often people went on picnics. And he saw that the trend line for picnics was in free fall, just like every other form of social connection. And when he put it all together, he found that over the course of a few decades, half of all civic infrastructure in America had vanished. Today in Radio West, we're talking about the film. We have with us the directors Pete and Rebecca Davis. I think one of the reasons the documentary works so well is you guys got really lucky in the sense that there are this series of epiphanies that you can move through the story of these revelations in Robert Putnam's life. And one of those, the first one, seems to be the inaugural address of President John F. Kennedy. This is seems like when Robert Putnam really feels inspired and moved to do something.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
Ask what you can do for your country. And honestly, I'm now 80 years old, and yet the hair on the back of my neck now telling you that story stands up because it was a hugely important emotional moment for me because I thought he was speaking directly to me. Bob Putnam, have things to do for your country.
This moment was significant for us, you know, in two ways in the story of Bob. You know, for one, at that time, Bob considered himself a Republican and his wife Rosemary considered herself a Democrat. And that kind of spoke to the less polarized moment, you know, that we were in the data at that time. You know, that's playing out in Bob's personal life. You know, now that's much less common that people, you know, report, you know, dating or marrying across party lines as polarization has grown. So they go on their first date there, and this is when Bob really feels a call to action that ends up, you know, setting his life on the path it would follow when he hears Kennedy say, you know, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. And that was, you know, obviously a famous speech, and you know, it spoke to Bob at the time, and he committed himself to a life of service, he says at that moment. But that was also kind of in the conversation at that time. There was a sense in the kind of greater morality of America, this sense of, you know, solidarity and service and giving back. And beyond that, you know, now Bob kind of looks to, you know, a much more kind of individualistic view of most Americans as we kind of look out at our role as citizens.
Well, Putnam mentions Kennedy is expressing, this is what you say in the film, is Kennedy's expressing an attitude about society that was, it's right on the verge of changing dramatically. Putnam describes it as a plunge.
Totally. And this is the main finding of Bob's major work, Bowling Alone, which is that in the 50 years since Kennedy gave that speech, we had a giant drop in the amount of community organizations that were there, the amount of time that people spent at community organizations, the number of people who say that they're members of community organizations. And this is across all geographies, all demographics, and all types of organizations. So, you know, you go religious congregations, you know, in Kennedy era, 90% of people would belong to one. Now it's crossed underneath 50%. You know, unions would be at one third, you know, to 40% of the workforce. Now only 6% of the private labor force is unionized. You know, the amount of picnics we go on gets cut in half in that period. You know, the amount of times we're playing cards, the amount of neighbors we're having over to the house, and all of these various civic organizations that were huge then, like the Elks and the Oddfellows and the Masons and the, you know, the NAACP, the Sierra Club, all these different types of groups where people are meeting in chapters. And so we show at the beginning of the film, you know, how that might look in soft, fuzzy cultural memory. You know, we'd go from a country where "ask not what your country can do for you" really resonates to a country where most people would look at that cynically. But then Bob comes along and finds actual data of literally the social structure of our daily lives are changing.
I love also how he's finding that where he goes to find some of this stuff, like the, I don't know, the international makers of napkins, like he looked and realized, and that was the insight he got from also the picnic association about, like he had to really dig to find this stuff.
Yeah. And I think, you know, that was, you know, another thing that drew us to Bob's work was this chance to explain to audiences, like, you know, studying culture, there are knowable things we can find out there in the data, but it's a matter of finding out who's been looking at the rhythms of American life. So there's, you know, some national surveys like the Time Diary and, you know, Bureau of Labor Statistics that is, you know, doing this stuff on the national level. But, you know, Bob wanted to not just look at, you know, major, you know, organizational involvement. He wanted to make sure that, you know, it wasn't just that the way we were getting together was kind of shifting and, you know, falling off kind of the usual way we might be counting. And so he ended up going to advertising agencies. And famously, he went to DDB Needham, which was a big kind of, you know, Mad Men era advertising agency who had been collecting data on things like dinner parties and picnicking because, you know, their clients were paper product companies and ketchup companies. And it was important to them to know, you know, what are our picnicking trends, you know. And so Bob was able to see it wasn't just on the kind of formal ways we were getting together, you know, in religious groups, in unions. You know, it was also the informal ways. We were having less dinner parties. We were having less picnics. We were, you know, knowing our neighbors' names, you know, less than we used to.
Is that his gift, Robert Putnam, in some ways? Just being incredibly creative about where to look for some of these things that might tell him something about the culture?
Yes. You know, this is kind of what Bob is famous. This is what Bob is the Michael Jordan of among social scientists, is he takes some big, giant, meaty, deep, broad question about what's going on in America. And then he's able to find ways we could actually attempt to put numbers to this. Some have called him an Old Testament prophet with charts because he mixes this social science skill with messages that come out of that data that actually are really moral, you know, about how do we want to live as Americans, as a country.
And of course, in Bowling Alone, it wasn't just a catchy title. He actually dug in on our bowling data, you know, and found there was a time in America where more Americans bowled than voted, you know, and then was able to chart those declines. You know, and in doing so, you know, he was also lifting up these things that, you know, your average American might not realize are important, you know, for things like a functioning democracy. You wouldn't automatically think, oh, bowling and democracy functioning. But what his research does is it brings those two things together. And he takes a deeper look and says, you know, it's not just that you're out there, you know, having a good time with your friends, although it is good for your mental health to be, you know, out and engaged with other people. It's the conversations that happen when you're sitting on the sidelines waiting for your turn to roll, you know, with your neighbor who might disagree with you a little bit, but, you know, where you're engaging with each other in a more, you know, jovial and formal environment. So then when you are out at the city council meeting, you know, you're not heading to blows when you have a disagreement.
I want to have you explain to us, Pete, you mentioned some of his influential work outside of Bowling Alone. And let's talk about the work he does in Italy. This is very early in his career, and you lay this out in the documentary. He writes this incredibly influential political science study, and he does it by observing basically the effectiveness of regional governments. I think it's in southern Italy. And this sort of leads to this epiphany for what becomes Bowling Alone. But can you tell us about what happens in Italy with Rob?
Yeah, one of the things that has led credibility to Bob's work is that Bob, despite being a rather communal person, he did not come to research on community because he was particularly interested in community. He came to research on community because that was a finding that showed up in his data in his first major political science work, making democracy work, the study of Italy. So here's how the study went, if I can say it very quickly. It was over 20 years. And what happened is that Italy decentralized its government from a centralized government to a bunch of regional governments. It's as if America never had states. And right. Then suddenly in the 70s, we decided to have states and they'd all start in the same year.
Yeah.
So this is a perfect political science experiment because you can follow each of these state governments and see which ones succeed and which ones fail. And so the first task at hand is try to measure government success. And so he was able to do that through all these different measurements, you know, polling people on, are you happy with your government? Does the government have a stable, you know, is it changing leaders all the time or are there kind of stable leadership class? You know, is it building daycare centers and building roads and building hospitals? Is it doing what it wants to do? And it turns out you can organize the regions from the best, most functional, most beloved region of Emilia-Romagna all the way down to a very dysfunctional region of Calabria and Basilicata. And then here comes where you can have your amazing findings. The most important thing is now, why regions like Emilia-Romagna do better than Basilicata? And what Bob found was it wasn't necessarily economics. It wasn't necessarily rural versus urban or education
levels. Wasn't education. Yeah.
Yes. And what it was the amount of soccer clubs and bocce leagues and choral societies and local newspapers and the amount of people meeting in the plaza and talking. It was community life.
Yeah.
And so what he found was, okay, civic culture, a vibrant, dense civic culture of a lot of people joining things, a lot of people participating in clubs, a lot of people knowing their neighbors, a lot of people, you know, engaged in public life leads to better government, and not just better government, better every institutional measure, better schools, better hospitals, better public health, better happiness. And correlation does not equal causation, but you can actually find a causal mechanism by thinking about, well, okay, what is the techniques of how community life would lead to good government? And what it is this concept called social capital.
Yeah.
The idea that when you have these networks, you have more social trust, and that social trust greases the wheels of a functioning society. More people can spread good ideas, more people help each other out, more people feel like they belong to the project of the public, so they throw trash away in trash cans instead of on the ground because they know their neighbors and their neighbors are going to see them and they feel like they're part of their neighbors. More people watchdog the government. The people in the government are connected with everyone, so they want to do good. And all of that adds up and you have functioning institutions. And so that was the big finding of his study, Making Democracy Work. What makes democracy work? It's community life.
What is social capital? Like, how does it work? It's one of the things Putnam sort of works you through in the film. It's so connected to this idea of reciprocity, but social capital goes beyond that. That's, you're not necessarily getting something. Well, you are getting something, but it's about the community. Maybe explain that for us.
Yeah, social capital is one of those phenomenons that's, you know, a little bit like water. You know, it's all when you're in it as a fish, you know, it's all around you and you don't necessarily realize it. But when you don't have it, it's hard to breathe. You know, Bob's research, when he found this social capital mechanism that had, you know, been kind of going largely unnoticed by a lot of researchers at that time, as far as, you know, its connection to a functioning democracy, it's partly because, you know, it's the stuff of the everyday, you know, and again, this gets to kind of Bob looking in kind of funny corners for where to measure, looking at our picnics, looking at our dinner parties, looking at our bowling leagues in Italy, you know, looking to the bocce club, you know, because it is through our social capital, our relationships with other people, our trust in our neighbors, you know, being multiplied, you know, in a functioning democracy, you know, millions of times, you know, every single day, you know, as we're walking to the store and exchanging words with the person behind the counter, or running into neighbors on the street or attending a PTA meeting. Those are all the places that we're building social capital day to day as citizens in our community. And I think it's one of those things where it is everywhere all around us. And so because of that, it can often go unnoticed. And, you know, unfortunately, though, where it starts showing up is, you know, when we have less of it, you know, our democracy starts not functioning as well. And our lives start to not function as well, because it's through our social capital that, you know, when we lose a job, we have a network that we can activate to say, hey, does anyone know anyone who's hiring, you know, and get that friend to kind of put in a good name or connect us. And we all know that that ends up being a lot easier than, you know, throwing a resume, you know, out to the wind on the internet.
But then comes a kind of setback, or at least the critique now shows up. And you're right, you talk about this in the film. He notices this piece in the Washington Post that says bowling alone is bunk.
That's seared in my memory.
A nation of people who bowl alone. Something's wrong with this picture.
The critics said that Bob had counted the wrong clubs.
People are indeed grouped together. U.S. Youth Soccer now has 2.4 million members.
Or that the things I'd counted were old-fashioned and we were doing new-fashioned things.
I think the focus for a lot of people has changed.
The premise is that we're in a period of weakened community ties. We're bowling alone, all that stuff that we've heard. Turns out not to be true.
It was frankly deeply depressing. Deeply depressing. It felt to me as though, my God, I'm a liar.
You know, there were people who said, oh, this is just nostalgia. Right. This is just kind of cultural crankiness. This is get off my lawn, old man yells at cloud. And that it wasn't rigorous. And, you know, maybe they even admit, okay, maybe your data is right, but it's just data about these old types of clubs. And if we're not going to, you know, Eagles Club meetings anymore, we're going to yoga class or a support group or youth soccer and meeting our neighbors there. And so this set Bob out on, you know, instead of just letting the debate end there, Bob took 5 years and he said, okay, let me really try to answer this. I'm going to go find every single possible data I can find on all types of community engagement. And in the years that have followed, most people have not in the last 20 years found, you know, oh, here's all this data that showed up that shows Bob's wrong. What usually happens is here's all this data that showed up in the last 20 years that Bob's right, you know, and you see these articles every month. You know, we've been seeing it since tracking it with working on the film for the last 8 years.
That's Pete Davis, along with his sister and co-director Rebecca Davis. Their documentary is called Join or Die, which you can see with us tonight at the Downtown Salt Lake City Library. We have details on our website, radiowest.org. We'll get started at 7. We'll take another break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from our members. Find out how at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about a documentary film called Join or Die. The title is the message. It's a film about why you should join a club and why the fate of America depends on it. It's about the work of the social scientist Robert Putnam, who wrote the book Bowling Alone. Putnam pulled together data from everywhere he could think of to show how people engaged in their communities, and he found the country's civic infrastructure is crumbling. We have with us the filmmakers Rebecca and Pete Davis. One of the theories that you explore in the documentary I wanted you to say something about, it's this idea that what happened to American civic life was deliberate. This is a point made by Jane McAlevey, is that how she pronounced it?
Jane McAlevey, yeah.
I believe a deliberate strategy of cultivating individualism begins in the early 1970s to roll back the gains of the civil rights movement, the women's movement, and the trade union movement with a strategy of downgrading the concept of the communal and the collective and elevating the idea that the individual is supreme. People do have less connections.
Pete and I, as we were writing the script for the film and, you know, choosing people that we were interviewing, we were careful to not be prescriptive about what exactly happened here. Because it is hard to point to just one thing. And so we tried to, you know, kind of lift up a couple of different thoughts on kind of what's going on. So we interviewed Jane McAlevey, the great labor organizer, you know, who does think we should look at, you know, what policies have kind of come on the scene in recent years that have made it harder for us to build solidarity, you know, in the workplace. We also lift up the ideas of Utah State Senator Mike Lee, you know, who has different thoughts than Jane McAlevey, that, you know, the policies of the government are bogging us down and, you know, they need to get out of the way so that we can have more local self-reliance and local problem solving happening in our communities.
I should mention, I think, but you probably know that Mike Lee is going to raise kind of a red flag for some people because of his role supporting Donald Trump. And it may alter the way people react to his commitment to, you know, to the social capital project that he has going in Congress. It's going to raise a larger question of how all of this idea of social capital fits in the current political environment when, you know, people's heads at the moment are swimming in the turmoil of just the first few weeks of the Trump administration. Your film was completed before any of that. It doesn't undermine the idea of social capital, but I just wonder how it fits in the current moment.
Yeah, you know, there's a really simple, you know, it's not easy, but it's kind of simple and coherent aspect to this that applies to pretty much any political or civic situation, whether things are going well or things are going bad, whether you agree with who's in office or whether you don't like who's in office. Yeah. Everything you want to get done in politics as a people requires community organizing. If you like something a government is doing, local, state, or national, to implement the programs that they are doing, that requires community buy-in. If you want to fight the government, that requires community organizations. All political movements are based on community organizations. And anything you want to achieve outside of the government requires, you know, community organizing. And so everything, kind of everyone needs to turn on to this who cares about this. And, you know, one of the things we learned from working with Bob for a long time is just noticing how much so many social movements have a community organizing aspect to them. Mm-hmm. You know, I used to think that all those 60s, 70s social movements, you know, the civil rights movement, gay rights movement, feminist movement, green movement, I used to think that that might have been a rebellion from the hunky-dory mid-century community life. You know, oh, we're all in these congregations, we're in these elks clubs, and suddenly there's this other way of being together that are all these rights movements. But what Bob kind of turned us on to is actually the reason that all those movements took off then is because people were in such a habit of achieving things together. And if you read, you know, any of the kind of concrete materials from those movements, like people's memoirs of those movements, you'll find it was, you know, Ella Baker and Martin Luther King being from congregations that they grew up in that showed them how they could run a meeting and give speeches and things like that. It was the fact that, you know, we have this whole history of all these conservation organizations that led to the environmental movement. It was the fact, you know, you look at a wonderful documentary, How to Survive a Plague, about the history of ACT UP, the great gay rights organization that fought AIDS in the 80s. Their advocacy was for these major changes in Washington organizations like the CDC and the National Institute of Health. And so you'd think the history of AIDS research and gay rights happening in the 80s was all about machinations of what's happening in Washington. But what, you know, that movie, How to Survive a Plague, shows is it was actually basement meetings in New York of people in civic organizations meeting up and building the solidarity and sharing the ideas that led to the protests, that led to things. Whether you're in a government right now, and we want to shout out local and state government, not just what's going on federally, and you want to roll out some initiative, it's not going to work if there's not buy-in and social capital. And if you're fighting the government and trying to change things, that's not going to work unless you figure out how to come together and learn the art of association.
You know, I think that was something that really drew us to Bob's work, too, is this decentering of Washington. You know, I think for myself, coming to this film after, you know, working in national news, you know, there has just been such a swing, you know, as cable news, you know, and then, you know, so much of our life now being online news has taken over our life. There's been a real centering of Washington at the expense of, you know, what's happening down the street from us. You know, and I think, you know, what Bob's work in social capital tells us is like, yes, you need to know what's happening in DC, but if you want to change things, you know, there, you better start with what's happening on your street, getting your neighbors together. And you're going to be able to have an impact, you know, tomorrow on that. You know, and I think that's something that's, you know, sadly, that message is at risk as so many of our great local news outlets, you know, have shut down over the last two decades.
There's this really kind of gripping moment in the documentary when Robert Putnam goes back to his data sets and he realizes that when you look at the trend line, I mean, you figure, oh, the trend line is only going down. But one of the things he notices, if you go way back in the country's history, civic engagement wasn't always going down. There was a period of time in the country when it was going up. I mean, as you mentioned, Pete, in the documentary, before unions were in decline, they were growing. Before churches were losing membership, they were really growing. And there was a time when there was, as Putnam mentions, there was all of this inequality. People mistrusted, you know, bickering political parties. So they reached for something else. This is when they started joining clubs. Like, people were pissed off about political division and economic inequality. And that's when they started joining clubs. So it seems like that's a kind of a hopeful message for you guys there.
Totally. You know, what was so amazing about that finding is it kind of makes sense. It's, you know, if you're saying at mid-century, there were all these clubs that everyone was part of and all these ways of engaging and all these initiatives, and there was this culture that was fostered of joining all across America, you have to ask the question of where did that come from?
Right.
And it turns out that wasn't here, you know, in 1780. That wasn't, you know, it had to be cultivated. There was a wave of civic creativity at the turn of the last century. Literally, there was an American Bowling Congress that helped support the spread of bowling and all the bowling leagues that Bob mentions in the title. There was a wave of unionization. There was a wave of changes to how we'd structured cities so that public parks and public playgrounds and plazas were created. There was, you know, cultures of meeting spaces like roller rinks and diners. And there were all these reforms in politics that brought more people in and had more ways people could interact. And then there was a flourishing of all these different types of clubs, you know, from the founding of the Boy Scouts to the founding of the Rotary Club, four people meeting for lunch one day and deciding, let's meet for lunch regularly. And that then becomes a giant international organization that's kind of changed the history of this the world. And so that's basically the message of the film, which is, you know, it's not just join a club, it's participate in this in a new wave of civic creativity. It's not a nostalgic message of you necessarily have to join all those clubs that were founded in 1910. It's let's take that same spirit that they had in, you know, at the turn of the last century and this century, let's start building again. And that's why at the end of our film, we really wanted to show six different civic leaders that were at the forefront of this new wave of civic life.
Yeah, this is the solution part of the film that you take on. And there's this great line early on in the film, like first thing from this gentleman who's showing you around an Oddfellows Hall. And he says something that I kind of found really profound. He said, whatever your burn is in the world, there's something out there for you. So would you talk about that finally? I mean, one of the things you mention in the film is that you don't have to set out to build community. You say community is what happens when you do what you love together. So talk about that part.
Yeah, I mean, I think that can really be a first step for folks that, you know, want to get involved but don't know where to start. You know, it can be a matter of just taking a self-census of what are you doing alone in your life right now? If it's walking alone, start a walking club. If it's cooking alone, you know, start a dinner cooperative with your neighbors where you all take turns, you know, making dinner, you know, one night a week for each other. And then suddenly instead of cooking dinner 7 nights a week, you're only cooking dinner one night a week. So it doesn't have to be that, you know, you're setting out to do something that's way outside, you know, the limits of your daily life. And those have been some of the, you know, incredibly, you know, inspiring stories that we're able to, you know, both feature in the film and, you know, in the, we've done 350 community screenings of the film since we released it 2 years ago. And, you know, we're meeting tons of community builders around the country doing just that. You know, we encourage folks, you know, listening to this or those that are able to, you know, get out and see the film, you know, just really do that self-reflection on, you know, what has become, you know, an individualized activity in your life that doesn't need to be as a first step.
You think people will go bowling again? I kind of loved bowling when I was a kid. And I wonder what the modern day thing of that is. Is it pickleball instead
it's
of
pickleball.
Bowling? Yeah. Is that right? Yeah.
Well, this is one interesting thing about civic design that Bob points out about bowling. What's so special about bowling for community building is that most of your time you're sitting on the bench talking with the other people. There's a lot of downtime in bowling. And actually, there's a real special, serious insight there, which is that our community life needs to have a lot of community time in it. So if you're starting a civic group to achieve some mission, and usually that helps, you know, to have some outward purpose of your civic group, have breathing room inside of your civic group just for community building and getting connected. It doesn't need to be driving towards your mission all the time, because if you're hard driving towards your mission, if you're like a environmental activist group and you're always like, all of our time needs to be efficiently spent advocating the state house on environmental policy or something, or cleaning up the river, people are going to get burned out, and people are never going to they're not going to make those hooks that will keep them going, which is the relationships with each other. And so that is what bowling has, which is, you know, it's so goofy that you can't take it too seriously. And there's a lot of time sitting on the bench together chatting. And so we just recommend that for every group is have a little bit of a spirit of time to sit on the bench and chat in between your roles.
Yeah. And I think, you know, there's power in the group, which I think is often underestimated. And so to just share, you know, one anecdote related to pickleball that you bring up, you know, someone we met while touring the film, you know, told us about their pickleball league in Los Angeles and said, it, you know, it's changed their life. You know, they go all the time and it's an incredibly important part of their life. Well, when the wildfires, you know, hit out in LA recently, I heard from, you know, this pickleball player that a member of their team lost their house and moved in with her. You know, and so when we don't have those networks to lean on, you know, this is where the die and join or die comes from. These become life or death, you know, real survival questions for us, you know, for those of us that have a community that we've built up, you know, that social capital, that trust and reciprocity, so that when we need to call someone, you know, to give us shelter, to care for us when we're sick, those relationships, you know, are there and ready to come through for us.
Congratulations, you two, on this. Thank you very much.
We're very grateful.
Thanks so much for having us.
It's Rebecca Davis, along with her brother Pete Davis. They co-directed the documentary Join or Die, which we're going to be screening at the Downtown Salt Lake City Library tonight at 7. You can get details on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're on YouTube at KUER90.1. We're on Instagram at Radio West, or you can just email us at radiowest@kuer.org. Our intern is Katrina Cano, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.